Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing
off.
Republican candidates pull stunts to draw attention to themselves. The NSA announces it will delete all that phone metadata it collected, and the world is in uproar about the dentist who killed a lion. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, correspondent for The Upshot at The New York Times. On the left is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at truthdig.com. On the right is Tim Carney, senior political columnist for The Washington Examiner, and our special guest is Joan Walsh, editor-at-large at salon.com and MSNBC political analyst. Welcome to all of you. So the first Republican presidential debate is coming up next Thursday, and it will include only the 10 candidates sitting highest in the polls. And so that means if your name isn't Jeb Bush or Donald Trump, you need to do everything you can to draw attention to yourself this week. So, of course, we have seen Ted Cruz call Mitch McConnell a liar on the Senate floor, which drew public rebukes from many senators and further alienated Cruz from the D.C. Republican insider class, an alienation he's probably not displeased about. Lindsey Graham made a YouTube video of himself destroying his cell phone after Donald Trump gave out his phone number. Rand Paul released a video of himself literally cutting the tax code with a chainsaw. And Mike Huckabee repeatedly said the president is leading the people of Israel to the ovens with the Iran deal. He said that more than once. So, Joan, what was the best stunt that you saw this week in the Republican field?
I think Huckabee's was the best stunt and the worst stunt at the same time. He also, remember, said that he actually stood at the oven door. He's been to the oven door. He was there as a tourist, actually. He has not literally been to the oven door. So that was a new low. And it really did show this shocking combination of his desperation and also self-righteousness, that he couldn't be moved away from the notion that it might be an unacceptable thing for him to have said. So that was my favorite of the week.
Tim, I assume you appreciated the fact that one of these spats was about your favorite topic, the Export-Import Bank. What Ted Cruz said Mitch McConnell was lying about was whether or not he had cut a deal to reauthorize the Export-Import Bank, which is the government agency that guarantees loans for American exporters. Do you think Cruz was right in that fight he picked?
I thought the stuff about McConnell was both sort of off base factually and weird. How do you run for president by running against Mitch McConnell? It doesn't seem like that much of a cause. But the rest of it was about Export-Import Bank, which is corporate welfare, was about sort of the way Washington works. He uses a term, the Washington cartel, which I think is actually a pretty good way to describe sort of the collusion of big business and big government against free markets, against small business, against taxpayers. So I thought if you took out the personal stuff towards McConnell, which is what got most of the headlines but was a minority of the speech, I thought it was a great speech by Cruz, and I hope that it shows a Republican Party sort of really taking aim at corporate welfare.
Are you surprised that, you know, there's been so much attention on corporate welfare and pushback against the Republican establishment about being more about promoting business than shrinking government, and yet the base support we're not seeing so much showing up around Cruz as around Donald Trump, who has a long history in his own business of being cozy with the government and seeking out subsidies?
I think Trump is tapping into the same sort of dissatisfaction with the system, with, you know, whether it's the Washington cartel, as Cruz calls it, Mount Washington, as Jeb Bush calls it, or the, what does Rand Paul call it, a machine, that Trump is sort of in the most basic and demagogic way tapping into that anger. And so it's sort of, if Trump were kind of an electable politician who'd ever proposed a bill, that's where Ted Cruz is moving himself.
Bob, I wanted to get your take on the Mike Huckabee ovens comment, because it was remarkable. He said this and people were basically like, what are you saying? Geraldo Rivera literally begged him to apologize for having said this on Fox News. Not exactly hostile territory for Huckabee. And yet he just kept saying it over and over. What do you make of the idea that there's a market for this in the Republican primary?
Well, first of all, we've never come to grips with the worst barbarism in modern history, and what caused it, and what the result. But the real issue is, how did one of the best educated populations, a population that prided itself on science, on the arts, the great classical music, engage in the worst barbaric genocidal activity imagined? And, you know, this fascism was supported by BMW executives. It was supported by Mercedes-Benz executives. And there are echoes of it in our own culture now, and indeed in this campaign. Because at the heart of fascism is diverting attention away from the people that are causing the problems, or the system that's causing the problems. So instead of dealing with German militarism, instead of dealing with Germans' economic problems, it was the Jews. And if not the Jews, then it was the gypsies. And if not the gypsies, then it was the gays. And so the demonizing of the other, the scapegoating of the other, as a deliberate way of avoiding dealing with what caused the society to fail economically and other ways, is at the heart of the fascist appeal. And you have this irony here. He's warning about fascism, and at the same time, there's a part of the Republican Party that wants to demonize Mexican immigrants and wants to blame all of the problems that particularly white working class people are experiencing on the other. And that's the seed of fascism. And it's not populism, it's fascism, and we should call it by its name. And if you want to know, can it happen here in another advanced country, it would come by demonizing the stranger in our midst, the very thing that Jesus warned against.
John Harwood has a piece in the New York Times today basically about how anger went astray for the Republican Party. And he cites polling data about how Republicans are more angry about the government right now than any out-of-power political base has been going back decades in polling. And the point he sort of makes is that the anger has been undirected. And Republicans in Congress and in Washington haven't provided a clear answer about what they're going to do about the things that people are angry about. But Tim, I'm sort of wondering what you think the end game around that is going to be. I mean, I think, you know, Trump is clearly the candidate of anger. I don't know that I would describe him as a fascist like Bob does, and I certainly don't think most of his supporters are fascists. But I do think that Trump has tapped into that anger. The question is, Donald Trump, I don't think, is going to be any better, certainly will be much worse at delivering mm-hmm. on fixes to what people are angry about yep. than past Republicans. So where do you see the party taking that anger, turning it into a directed anger that would actually try to fix things that are problems?
Well, I'm going to engage in wishful thinking to answer your question, where I hope they'll go, because the constant pull in Washington is towards not addressing any of that anger, but to continuing to work with sort of the K Street Washington lobbying politician cartel and keep working within that. But ideally, what they would do if they wanted to really address that and form sort of a broader popular base with some populist appeal, it would involve saying, who's getting special favors from the government, and go after and sort of start stripping those out. And then the counterpart to that would be something, you know, it's a little more uncomfortable for people on the right, but, you know, what can we do with government policy to help regular people besides take away the special favors? And that's why I'm always talking to you about a payroll tax cut and that sort of thing. So I think you see the beginnings of these in people like Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio trying to lay out the reform conservatism agenda is looking at that. Taking away special interests favors, though, is always going to be the first step of that.
Joan, do you see anger being more usefully channeled on the left? I mean, it's not always unreasonable to be angry. There are a lot of things that are wrong in this country that need fixing, and especially on the fringes of both parties, people are, you know, the actual policies being implemented are relatively far from what they want. It makes sense that people are angry. Are Democrats managing to harness that in a way that looks more productive than Republicans?
I think they are. I mean, I really don't like comparisons between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, because Bernie Sanders is a person of great integrity, who's very serious about government and has devoted his life to making things better for people who have less. But the similarity is anger and a sense of unfairness. And, you know, he agrees on corporate welfare, for instance. But the anger is different, and the quality of the anger is different. I want to go back to what Bob said, because I'm not going to weigh in on whether it's fascist exactly, but the problem for the Republican Party is that there's too often been this default to the hatred of the other. And so, you know, I know Tim does not support Donald Trump, and I'm not going to say denounce Donald Trump. That's not my point here. But I think that people are reluctant to denounce Donald Trump, and they want to say, well, he represents anger, he represents frustration, and are reluctant to call out the fact that he also represents this scapegoating and you know, really horrible attacks on Mexican immigrants and the president to begin with. And there's an inability to wean the party from this reliance on the demonization of the other. And so, you know, we're kind of watching people to figure out, how do we rebuke Trump? How do we control Trump? How do we get people to turn against Trump without turning Trump against us? And I don't know that that balance is going to be very productive.
Well, on a more hopeful note, I want to talk about an issue where anger from at least a portion of the electorate seems to have translated into actual policy change, which is that this week the National Security Agency announced it would destroy years of logs of phone metadata, the information about who was calling and texting whom that had been secretly collecting before Edward Snowden's disclosures of the programs. The USA Freedom Act, which President Obama signed in June, gave the NSA 6 months to wind down that metadata program, but didn't require the NSA to delete the data it already had, which made this announcement something of a surprise. Bob, what did you make of this announcement? Were you surprised to see the NSA sort of agreeing to give this data up, and what do you make of that?
Well, I don't think they had a choice. They had 120 days, and I think the Freedom Act was quite clear. It has to be turned over to the private sector, and the only way they can hold on to that is for technical adjustments or because there are lawsuits, and that's why it's going to go another 120 days. I do think it's important to acknowledge the achievement of Edward Snowden and realize how despicable it is that just about, you know, most of the candidates now consider him a traitor, including, I guess, Hillary Clinton, and yet we would not have had this achievement, this reigning in of the NSA without Edward Snowden. The other thing that should be pointed out is there is not one single example where this data has led to revealing someone who's engaging in a terrorist act. Not one single example. And what's more, yes, it's an achievement for the democratic process and that you had a huge bipartisan vote in support of individual sovereignty of privacy and against limited government. So it's a victory, but it's a very small victory in the grand scheme of things, given the threat of the surveillance state growing every day, actually.
Well, let us know what you think about the NSA changes at kcrw.com/LRC. Up ahead, more on that, plus Cecil the Lion. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Take KCRW with you on one of our mobile apps. Available for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and our News 24 and Eclectic 24 streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of the New York Times. On the left is Robert Scheer, author of the new book, They Know Everything About You. Tim Carney, senior political columnist at the Washington Examiner, is on the right, and Joan Walsh of Salon.com is also with us. So, Tim, I was struck about this, you know, this agreement to delete this information is that in some ways, I mean, this government program of collecting these phone records is different from a lot of programs, but government programs are similar in that once they exist, the people who run them tend to come up with justifications about why they would should continue to exist. Here in New York, the NYPD has had this, you know, over decade-long program of infiltrating Muslim communities in the city and, you know, setting in performance in them, which in addition to being invasive and quite expensive, they can't point to anything in terms of, you know, actual terror events or other risks to public safety that created. And yet the NYPD has been very attached to the idea that they should continue doing that. So I wonder what you make in that environment of the willingness of the NSA to give up these records it collected rather after having for so long defending this program as something that they had to do.
Well, I certainly never would have predicted ahead of time that they would do that. If we had bet on this show a month ago, I would have said no way they're going to do anything more than what they're legally obligated to do. But again, giving up the records they've already collected is going beyond what they had to do. And I think it what they're now allowed to do going forward, it's not that they're prohibited from ever getting anybody's phone metadata. It's that they effectively have to get a warrant. They have to go to a FISA court. And so this, I think, is a great kind of conservative lesson in governing, that that government can't just be given a big assignment of, oh, go stop terrorism, do whatever you want, do it however you want to do it. But instead, there are going to be powers, but there needs to be checks and balances on those powers. And so unfortunately, it's really hard to – we can't know what the FISA court is doing in real time, and it's very hard to know it after the fact. But ideally, this does set us on a path towards that kind of good, constrained government that can do things it has to do, but it itself is regulated and heavily checked. And going beyond it by turning over this data is a rare and very pleasant surprise.
It is a pleasant surprise, but it does. Maybe I'm too cynical, and maybe I don't know if Bob would agree with me on this. But to me, it really just showed that there was nothing that they were getting from it, that they didn't produce anything from it, and they can afford to give it up. Is that too cynical,
Bob?
No, I don't think it's too cynical, but I think the main reason this was done is it was an enormous embarrassment to our main exporting companies, Apple, Google, and these folks. Mm-hmm. And they're getting tremendous pushback around the world. You know, what are you doing tapping Angela Merkel's phones? What are you doing with your Google trucks running around Europe? And so you have the European Union, you have people throughout the world saying, we can't trust these American companies because they're under the thumb of the American security organizations. And so the big pushback came from these companies, from Instagram, from Facebook, from Apple and Google. And that's a good thing. But we should recognize that this was just the tip of the iceberg, and that, in fact, and I would recommend to anyone, go to the Electronic Frontier Foundation. It's the greatest website for information on this, and follow the bills that are going through. Follow the hypocrisy. And the real issue was mentioned before is the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment says very clearly, and Chief Justice Roberts said this in a ruling a year ago, June, the Fourth Amendment, the idea of the Fourth Amendment that you cannot have general warrants and you go searching everyone was the spark that started the American Revolution. You have a right to private space. And that's what the government has, under both Bush and Obama, has attempted to destroy. And yes, it's great that so many Republicans joined a good number of Democrats. And that it was a great victory. Now they have to extend that to the other mechanisms for destroying our freedom.
I think there's an interesting juxtaposition between this surveillance story this week and what we saw happening in Cincinnati, where we had an unarmed black man shot by a police officer during a traffic stop over a missing front license plate, where it's really the body camera in that situation that made clear that the officer had no justification for the shooting. That body camera is why the officer has been charged with murder. And I think some people look at these stories and basically say, you know, well, the government looking through the metadata of my phone records is a theoretical problem. The long arm of the state shows up much more in the terms of low-tech things like police officers shooting people. I mean, obviously, it's not a choice between the two, but what do you make of those priorities, Joan, like in terms of where Washington should be focusing and, you know, the allowing local governments to run rampant even as the federal government is reined in?
Right. Well, obviously, that's wrong. And we do have a movement that's beginning to challenge it. And we wouldn't have that movement, I think, if we didn't have the dashboard cams and the body cams and all the other kinds of surveillance of police officers, which I think, you know, I want surveillance of the people who have the power to hurt us, to enforce the law. And I think that's been important. But I don't really want to have to choose. I think that both are big problems in our society.
I want to get to one last story this week before we move on, and that's one of the biggest news stories around the world, the death of Cecil the Lion. American dentist Walter Palmer hunted and killed the famed lion in Zimbabwe, and his guides have been arrested over claims that the hunt was illegal. This sparked international condemnation and revulsion, and frankly, what I thought were some over-the-top and irresponsible responses, including Piers Morgan writing for the Daily Mail that Mr. Palmer should be hunted and stuffed like the lion he killed. Tim, I know you were saying before the show that you wanted to offer a qualified defense of Walter Palmer, which is not something I've heard a lot of people offering. So what's your defense of hunting a lion with a bow and arrow and killing it?
First, to make sure I don't get hunted and stuffed by Piers Morgan, killing this this special collared lion, which was and illegally luring it off of the land, which is off of the preservation, which is what he's charged with. None of that is defensible. But if you look at Palmer's letter explaining what his own defense, and if it's true, he said he thought he was paying for a legal hunt. And so you might say, well, how can there be a legal hunt of lions? And you look at the other animals he killed, he was killing bighorn sheep out in New Mexico as part of a project that the state government runs, where they auction and raffle off for hundreds of thousands of dollars licenses to kill a bighorn sheep. If you can get it, you can get it. And what they do with this money is they then pour it into rebuilding the habitat and that sort of thing. And so a lot of it, you kill an older male who's beyond mating age, so it doesn't negatively affect the population. And it, in fact, because you're paying $100,000, $50,000 for this kill, you're doing it in such a way that will help the species. And so you look at what he's been doing sort of with his free time instead of, you know, being a golfer or whatever else you might do. A lot of hundreds of thousands of dollars, or $100,000 at least, he's been pouring into rebuilding this habitat. Now, maybe he thought this was going to be a legal hunt where, again, he was cutting a five-figure check. He did not realize that he was killing this particular lion who was collared, who was part of a study, and he claims he did not realize that it was being lured sort of through bait off a reservation. So that's my qualified defense of at least the act of hunting and paying five figures or six figures to hunt big game, even when they're endangered species.
I see Joan shaking her head.
Well, you know, it's really his responsibility to know whether what he's doing is legal or not. And it was so graphic. It was so hideous. The tribalism of it, the symbolism of it, you know, I think he also was accused of illegally shooting a bear in Wisconsin.
He served a year of probation, in fact.
Yeah. Right? So, you know, this is a guy who gets off killing big animals. And in this case, he killed a beloved animal that was off limits to him. I do not join Piers Morgan and the online tribe that's going after him. I think that is excessive. But I'm also kind of, I have problems with the people who say, oh, you know, there's so much outrage about the lion, but not enough outrage about this, that, or the other thing. I think you can be outraged about both. I'm not going to be baited into saying, oh, I guess I don't really care about Cecil because other people are being killed and other animals are being killed. That's stupid.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that's been a little bit of a fallacy. I mean, thinking about it myself, like, I get outraged over things people do on airplanes. So who am I to tell people that they can't be outraged over the death of a lion because people are dying? But I am interested, Bob, why do you think this story has connected so much with people? Because there are a lot of terrible things that happen in the world, and this one has really enraged people in a way that is unusual. Do you have a sense of why this?
Well, maybe partially because they don't think they're the kind of person who would go out and kill a prize lion, and then certainly don't have the money to pay for that privilege. So it's feeling a great deal of anger towards someone that you don't recognize as being like yourself. There was a story in the New York Times that I thought was far more important in terms of animal protection and inhumanity, and that was an incredible story. I think it should be a candidate for the Pulitzer, about the people who go and collect the fish that serves as pet food and how they're kept in a situation of slavery on these fishing ships, and the kinds of techniques that are used, and all of which is aimed at giving us a pet food supply. And that story really hasn't gotten very much attention, the working conditions, what it does to the environment, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, there is something very selective in our outrage. And, you know, I can't answer the question because I'm not one of those who responded to the lion story quite as strongly as, say, I did to the fact that these people were slaves who were collecting our pet food.
Tim, what did you make of the mass reaction to this? Because I tweeted out the Piers Morgan article basically saying, you know, it's not okay to call for the death of people even when they do bad things. and I'm not in favor of this lion hunt, but I, you know, the lynch mob is unsettling. And I that's a term that we shouldn't throw around, although there are people like literally, including Piers Morgan, basically calling for this guy's death. I mean, I feel like we don't see with most horrible stories. Why do you think we've seen such an over-the-top reaction here?
Well, first, it is made possible by Twitter and Facebook, and that stirs up these things where there's somebody, as Bob was saying, who does something we literally can't imagine ever saying, oh, there is a beautiful lion, let me kill it. My friend Radley Balco writes all the time about, you know, police barging into people's houses, you know, people die, the guy kills a cop, the guy who lives in the house kills a cop, and he goes to jail. Every dog got killed by a cop story gets more attention than... Right. You know, guy spends his life in jail. And part of it, to try to identify the moral sense behind that, it's that animals are innocent, but they're not just innocent. They're sort of extra innocent. You know, a murder victim doesn't sort of deserve to die, but we understand them as human beings, as being identifiable like us. Animals are innocent in sort of the deepest sense, where they couldn't possibly do anything immoral because they don't sort of have a moral sense. And I think that that's kind of what people are tapping into. And as a Christian, I see, you know, you have an obligation to take care of the vulnerable, the defenseless, and the innocent, and specifically an obligation to take care of the animals that are put here. So to pointlessly mistreat them is seen as particularly offensive. It's an abuse of power, in a sense.
And I think lions also have a particular symbolic primal hold on our imagination. We fear them, but we love them. You know, Aslan, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. There's just so many examples of the Lion King. There's this mythical, you know, bond we feel with them. And the pictures were so graphic and so disgusting. I mean, I'm not defending it, but I did feel it at the same time that I feel a certain kind of hypocrisy about the fact that cops killing dogs is more of an outrage to many people than cops killing people. I agree with Tim on that.
Well, we've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Bob Scheer, your soapbox.
Yes, we're coming on this week on the 70th anniversary of what I consider to be the greatest terrorist act in human history, and I just want to read what Hiroshima's mayor said about it a few years back. Quote, "That fateful summer, 8:15 a.m., the roar of a B-29 breaks the morning calm. A parachute opens in the blue sky. Then suddenly, a flash, an enormous blast, silence, hell on earth. The eyes of young girls watching the parachute were melted. Their faces became giant, charred blisters. The skin of people seeking help dangled from their fingernails." It goes on in that vein. And in Santa Monica, at least one city, Wednesday, they're having a ceremony to honor and mark that egregious act. Meant in honor of the people who died.
Tim Carney, what's your rant?
We've had more videos come out about Planned Parenthood, and that increasingly what it's showing us is why Planned Parenthood is so valuable to the biotech industry. That whether you're talking about are they haggling over prices for just to cover their costs on these human body parts, or is it actually a for-profit thing, that distracts from the fact that it's very clear that if you are a biotech industry looking for human organs, the single greatest supplier of freshly killed humans is going to be Planned Parenthood. And so this tells you something about what this organization does.
Joan Walsh, what's on your mind?
Well, it feels puny compared to those two things, but I really thought that the political world made way too much of those 12 individuals who gathered in New Hampshire and told us what they loved about Donald Trump this week. And I criticized them, and I was told I was an elitist, but I really think that the wishful and magical thinking at work in their descriptions of Donald Trump and the seriousness with which we handled that as political media is really part of why we're in so much trouble in this country.
For my rant, I just want to urge people to pick up the current issue of New York Magazine. The cover story is about 35 of the women who have accused Bill Cosby of rape or sexual assault. And I think it's instructive to look at this story next to the UVA rape story, with two huge errors made by the media of different sorts covering sexual assault. With Cosby, these accusations have been out there for so long and were ignored for so long in a way that they should not have been. In the case of Rolling Stone and UVA, you had a rush to run with one case without interviewing the accuser. These are both obviously terrible failures in how to cover sexual assault. It's a hard thing to cover right, but it's something that the media needs to do a better job, because both kinds of errors are big problems. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Robert Scheer, Tim Carney, and Joan Walsh. Laura Dine Million and Sarah Singer Schiff produced today's program. Our engineer is Kat Yore. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.